What I am going to try to do is tell something of a story about labor politics during the Reconstruction process, which I think 100 years ago, which I think is an important part of the story of labor in San Francisco more generally. And you know, rather than going through the whole story, since some of the people have read it, and there's a lot of people here who have lots of ideas and information, I'll try to make it somewhat brief. And perhaps we can have more give and take, not just about this topic, but about the history of labor in San Francisco more generally, and perhaps, you know, the importance of labor history to labor culture. So the story I'm going to tell today is a story about how one of America's most powerful labor movements confronted what was one of its most serious challenges. The Great Earthquake and Fire of 06 occurred at a time when San Francisco labor seemed to have a good deal going its way. It represented at least a third of all workers in the city. It had beaten back challenges from an anti-union employers group called the Citizens Alliance. And it could look forward to continued growth in a city of then 450,000 people that nearly everyone believed would soon become one of the major cities of the world, if it wasn't already. Most unions in San Francisco then belonged, of course, to the San Francisco Labor Council. But the council was a little more than a clearinghouse for individual locals. The strongest, most unified contingent in the local labor movement was the Building Trades Council, a centralized federation of all the construction trades, led by two very effective, very efficient, but very undemocratic leaders. The president, Patrick Henry McCarthy, an immigrant from Ireland, and a former carpenter, and Olaf Tveitmo, a Norwegian immigrant and former cement mason, who was both secretary of the BTC, the Building Trades Council, and the editor of its weekly paper, Organized Labor, which, of course, still exists. Both of which still exist. but they're much more democratic now, I'm sure, than they were back then. Unions belonging to the Building Trades Council represented the large majority of building tradesmen in the city, and all were men at that time. In fact, the BTC was so powerful that McCarthy and his allies could set wages and hours for the various trades unilaterally. They were, in a sense, sort of working class economists. They had to figure out what price the market could bear. They had to figure out who seemed to need, you know, a higher wage, who hadn't had a higher wage in a while. They negotiated with themselves in many ways, more than with the contractors themselves. Here you had a Building Trades Federation which organized 20 to 30,000 building trades workers from all the different trades in the city. The trades were individual, they had their own individual locals, as they still do, of course, now. Carpenters Local 22, for example, one of the largest locals. But in many ways, these individual trades were not independent. Their power depended on the power of all the building trades together. In fact, if you wanted to work on a building site anywhere in San Francisco, pretty much anywhere in San Francisco, you had to have a quarterly working card from the Building Trades Council, showing you were a paid-up member. You paid your $6, $7 or so quarterly. Kept going up, of course, as inflation would have it. And there are a lot of business agents who went around and checked those working cards. If you didn't have a working card, not only were you kicked off that building site, but you had a hard time getting a job in any building site anywhere in San Francisco and sometimes the whole Bay Area for a good year after that violation. So the BTC was very effective, and it said somewhat high-handed at times. It punished locals that went on strike without authorization. If you didn't have the okay from the Building Trades Council to go on strike, your strike would be broken. Strikebreakers would be brought in by the Building Trades Council against a striking union. So it didn't happen very much that a local went on strike without getting authorization. But at the same time, the Building Trades Council was something of a benevolent despotism in the sense that it guaranteed building trades workers in the city some of the highest wages that any building trades workers earned anywhere in the United States at that time. And in fact, higher wages than most workers anywhere in San Francisco earned. And part of the reason why it could do that is that the Building Trades Council followed a sort of iron discipline towards contractors. Contractors, of course, were there were no really large contracting companies to speak of in the city at the time. And so you had this iron discipline, this unified building trades council of 20 to 30,000 members. And on the other hand, you had contractors who had, you know, 7 employees here, 8 employees on this site, didn't have very many permanent employees at all. So the Building Trades Council was able to set rules, laws, they sometimes call them, for all contractors that they had to obey. And any contractor who was disobedient, who violated those rules, for example, hiring a non-union worker, would be called to appear before the executive board of the Building Trades Council to answer for his transgression. If found guilty, and most were found guilty, the contractors had to pay a fine to the Building Trades Council. It was usually $50, and it was usually given to charity or to rebuilding of a Catholic church. Those contractors who did not appear when they were summoned by the Building Trades Council would find the next day that they somehow didn't have any workers to do the job. And they would have problems with their, fulfilling their contract. Now, this strong labor movement was composed almost entirely of white workers, as most of you, I'm sure, know. The largest racial minority in the city at the time were Asian immigrants, mostly Chinese and Japanese immigrants, and they were completely shut out, or almost completely shut out, of the unions in the city. San Francisco unions explicitly barred Chinese and Japanese immigrants. White unionists considered them to be unfair competition and also to be culturally inferior. And of course, there is a huge corpus of racist literature about that. One of the most famous is a pamphlet written by Samuel Gompers with a friend of his, a cigar maker, who I believe lived in San Francisco for a time, Hermann Gutstadt, entitled Meat Versus Rice, Which Shall Survive? And in many ways, and this is not, of course, a part of the history of labor in San Francisco that we want to celebrate today, but it's an important irony, I think, to note. Being a explicitly racist and anti-immigrant labor movement at the time did not, in the short run, I don't think, hurt the power of organized labor. Because most white Americans in California and elsewhere agreed with the anti-Asian stance of organized labor. Asian immigrants had few friends in and out of politics at the time, some missionaries, some businessmen, but generally very few. By being the leaders, very often, of the anti-Asian movement in California, Tvitmo, for example, was secretary of the leading anti-Asian movement in California called the Asiatic Exclusion League. The unions in San Francisco and in California generally were able to speak as the representatives of all white Californians and all white Westerners more generally, rather than just the representatives of organized workers. And this gave them a leg up on unions elsewhere, in a sense, gave them an advantage that unions elsewhere did not have. Though, of course, it's not an advantage today that we'd want to celebrate, but one has to understand, I think, that racism in the short run does not always hurt the racists. Sometimes it helps their power to increase. It took a long struggle, as we know, for American unions, particularly those in the building trades, to shed their racist legacy. Well, in addition to labor's economic power, the city was governed for a time, both before and shortly after the earthquake, by a fairly unique institution in American political history. This was, as many of you know, the Union Labor Party, the ULP, which, despite accusations of corruption, which circled around it, and then proof of corruption, which ended up sinking it right after the earthquake, the ULP had the firm support of most white working class residents in the city. They voted to elect the candidate of the Union Labor Party to the mayoralty, a guy named Eugene Schmitz, a very handsome, tall, mustachioed musician, who had been head of the Musicians Union. He was a conductor. He was elected in 1901 as Union Labor candidate for mayor, in 1903 as Union Labor candidate for mayor, both times not carrying a few supervisors along with him, but not that many. Then 1905, when there was a fusion ticket opposed to the Union Labor Party, working class voters voted really as a huge block to support Schmitz, and he was reelected for a third time in 1905 and carried with him the whole Board of Supervisors, then 18 members. How many members are there now? 11? 18 members, all of whom were Union Labor Party nominees, plus the whole executive, all the executive offices in the city of San Francisco were elected that year. So it was a complete sweep for the Union Labor Party. Now this sounds, for those who know much about it, as if this was sort of going to become the equivalent of the social democratic parties in Europe, the German Socialist Party or the French Socialist Party, the British Labor Party, for example, and you might expect to hear after this, of course, the Union Labor Party linked up with other labor parties elsewhere in California, elsewhere in the country, and eventually the Labor Party was elected the President of the United States. Well, of course, I wish I could tell that story. But I can't. In fact, the Union Labor Party was, how should I put it, an imperfect vehicle for workers' aspirations. It did one thing that one of the reasons it was elected in 1901, and it continued to do this, it made sure that in strikes in San Francisco, the police stayed neutral. They did not come down with their billy clubs and sometimes guns on the heads of striking workers, which they had done before in San Francisco and which police in almost every city in the country could be counted on to do at this time in American history. But at the same time, it was a party which was controlled for the most part behind the scenes by a very clever lawyer named Abraham Roof, who had elaborate connections with various businessmen in town, especially with some of the people who ran the utility companies, PG&E, Pacific Gas Company, telephone companies, the United Railroads, which was the leading streetcar company at the time, all of which at this time were private companies. There was no Muni yet. And for a long time, actually, there was a private water company as well. And what Roof did is in the age-old, in some ways, pattern of urban corruption was, you know, he let it be known without actually saying so that if you wanted to get a contract from the city, you know, you had to pay up. And he made sure that the supervisors were kept happy as well, as he was and the mayor Schmitz were and other Union Labor Party personnel who were elected. This, as I'll get to in a moment, led to the downfall of the Union Labor Party, in effect, and unfortunately made sure that the Union Labor Party would not be a model for other workers elsewhere in the country, and made sure that, well, among other things, we would not have a Union Labor president. But the power of labor, one could give a whole talk about this in San Francisco at the time, because it was quite rare in American cities at the time for labor to be this powerful. It's a famous quote which Jules Tigel first pointed out to me, and which is you've probably heard before by the muckraking progressive journalist Ray Stannard Baker, which with some hyperbole in 1904 he wrote, marveling, "In San Francisco, we have a new kind of industrial peace, a condition perhaps without precedent, in which the ancient master, the employer, has been hopelessly defeated, and unionism reigns supreme." Well, as I noted, this labor's apparent political strength rested on a dishonest foundation, and after the earthquake and fire, this fact would be exposed by a very diligent prosecution team with the help of Fremont Older, the editor of the San Francisco Bulletin, one of the leading papers in town at the time. And even though the prosecutors primarily were not looking to destroy or weaken the power of organized labor itself, as opposed to the Union Labor Party, I think in the end, the downfall of the Union Labor Party did help to weaken the power of labor more generally. And so, in some ways, the story I'm going to tell, I am in the middle of telling, is a tragedy. Certainly, labor would be strong again in America, in San Francisco history, but the particular conjunction of political power, at least officially, and economic power was something that would really not come again for labor in this city. Now, this is, of course, a talk about history, but most of you here are associated one way or another with the labor movement today, I know. And so perhaps it might have some contemporary relevance, and maybe we can talk about what relevance it might have later on. The relationship between union activity and politics and organizing at the workplace is, as most of you know, rather central to the debate taking place today in American labor circles, in the city and in the nation as a whole. One of the major causes of contention between the union supporting John Sweeney's administration, the FLCO, and those united around Andrew Stern and John Wilhelm and their unions is precisely about this question of politics. How committed should the labor movement be to the Democratic Party? How much money should it spend on politics? How much money should it spend on organizing? What's the relationship between economic power or the lack of it and political power or the lack of it? These are burning questions. They were 100 years ago, and they remain so today. History does not repeat itself, but, you know, once in a while it whispers in similar ways. Well, back to the story. It's hard to overestimate the physical crisis that faced San Franciscans as a result of the few minutes of trembling on April 18th, 1906, and the 3 days of massive fires that followed. Over 28,000 buildings, in which about two-thirds of the population lived and worked, had been destroyed. A sizable number were dynamited in a successful attempt to arrest the fire. Approximately 300,000 people took the advice of local authorities and the free tickets offered by the Southern Pacific Railroad and evacuated the city. As many as 70,000 of them never returned as permanent residents. The most extensive damage was to both downtown and to the residential areas where working class people lived. Not all working class people, but especially the less well-off working class. The thickly settled areas between Telegraph Hill and Rincon Hill, where there were small factories, warehouses, cheap lodgings that had been competing for space since the 1870s. The former residents of these neighborhoods, predominantly unskilled, foreign-born, were the main ones that filled the tent camps that the U.S. Army set up, some in the Western Addition, some in the park itself, or squatted in improvised shacks which dotted the burned district. Miraculously, as you, I'm sure, know, fewer than 450 people were killed in the catastrophe, though I've heard that there's a new higher figure that local historians have been talking about since. But obviously the ravages suffered by the living would take many years to repair. San Francisco manufacturing continued a sharp decline from which it has never really recovered. As the Greater Bay Area mushroomed with refugees in Los Angeles, accelerated its meteoric rate of growth, San Francisco, which had been the first metropolis on the Pacific coast, soon relinquished its position of economic supremacy. Beat LA. However, in the first months after the disaster, those San Franciscans who remained worked with great energy and communitarian feeling. Ray Stannard Baker, again, work. I've never seen men work as they are working here. New steel rings to their hammers. Wagons go forth dusty with debris to return with shining new lumber. Cheerful wooden shacks spring up overnight with a little flag on top to let you know there will be no capitulation. Mayor Schmitz, to make sure that everybody was diligently working hard and looking towards the public spirit of the time, ordered saloon owners and liquor dealers to close for 2.5 months. Imagine San Francisco with no saloons for 2.5 months. The compliance which most people showed with this edict proved the sincerity of the post-earthquake spirit. Good thing it didn't last more than 2.5 months. The reorganization of San Francisco's political life began just as the rubble was being cleared and temporary residences and stores were being built. In fact, the very afternoon after the earthquake, on April 18th, Mayor Schmitz asked U.S. Army General Frederick Funston, who was commander of the Presidio, to order his troops to guard streets and set fire lines. Schmitz also issued a draconian proclamation authorizing soldiers and police to kill looters and other criminals. And he appointed the city's best-known businessmen, architects, bankers, lawyers, and a few labor leaders, to the Citizens Committee, which held its first meeting only 10 hours after the shaking stopped. So it seemed as if there would be this sort of respite from class hostilities, respite from what had been a very tumultuous class-divided politics in the city, a lot of strikes, a lot of turmoil, really beginning in the 1880s, but culminating with the City Front Strike, which some of you know about, in 1901, which really gave birth to the ULP itself and Schmitz's election, because a lot of union leaders got together and decided that, you know, they couldn't have police going and smashing unions anymore. They had to make sure that the police were going to be, if not on their side, at least not on the employer's side. But it seemed for a few months at least that organized labor would restrain its demands, that its opponents would be quiet as well. Organized labor, the building trades newspaper, had a big headline, big bold-faced headline, several weeks after the earthquake, which read, "No greed, small profits, and plenty of Western patriotism." And this was applied both to workers and to the employers. Both the Labor Council and the Building Trades Council announced that their trade rules would be indefinitely suspended on all relief work. And this included the requirement that building workers carry that paid-up quarterly working card, which had been, you know, as important to the building trades as the King James Bible is to evangelists. The Building Trades Council also imposed a wage freeze, which it had never thought to do before. At the first meeting of the Building Trades Council, held on a street corner a few days after the disaster, the delegates reported that three-quarters of their members had lost their homes, and just as important, a larger number had lost their tools. Their tools had been burned up in the fire as well. But they swore dedication to Western patriotism. In fact, the earthquake love, as some people called it at the time, everyone loving one another and working together, which of course happened after 9/11, happens after every disaster, natural or not, in American history at least, and probably in the history of many countries, was so great that in May, a top leader of the Labor Council, a guy named Walter MacArthur from the Sailors Union of the Pacific, wanted to have unionists and employers sign a general agreement under which workers would receive a set wage in return for a no-strike pledge. For perpetuity, forever, you know. No strikes, wages going up with inflation. This seemed to be a permanent settlement of the labor difficulties. There were a lot of businessmen who didn't like the idea, of course, of just allowing workers' wages to go up on a fairly regular basis. But MacArthur was trying to avoid what he thought would be a down draft of wages when a lot of new workers started flooding into the city, looking forward to jobs, rebuilding the city. So this was the dynamic that was beginning to be set up, even in May, even right a month after the earthquake took place. Another contributor to Labor Council paper put it this way, and this is one of these quotations that historians like to find because they sort of sum up what you'd like to say anyway. "The whole future of the labor movement, as of the city itself, depends upon the question of reconstruction." Well, not surprisingly, one cannot escape history. And less than a month after the earthquake and fire took place, this concord, this talk of concord between labor and capital was beginning to break down. Each side was blaming the other for taking unethical advantage of the gains to be made from reconstruction. They fought over the supply of workers. They fought over what a fair level of wages, rents, and prices would be. They fought over anti-union remarks by the general who was in charge of law and order during the Reconstruction period, General Frederick Funston. On one side, there were arguments that business was extorting workers, was running up prices, running up rents. On the other side, there were again, predictable accusations that there was a labor trust which was hindering the revival of commerce, that labor was strangling the Reconstruction by its unfair, illegitimate demands. In effect, as that anonymous writer I mentioned before put it, both sides decided that the future of labor's power in the city and, of course, of employer freedom, as employers saw it in the freedom, depended on who won these battles, who won the battle to define what would happen during Reconstruction. So it was a rather important period in the in the labor history and political history of San Francisco. Even though I've noted, the other day I went at Cody's Books in Berkeley looking for recent books on the earthquake. I noted how few comments there are in books on the earthquake, of which there will be many more next year, I'm sure, about labor. Now, you know, labor historians always think there's not enough on labor, but this is a rather unusual thing to note. I'm glad this film is being made, but someone out there should write a book to accompany the film, because it's we'll hear a lot about Caruso and so forth, singing and leaving the city, but very little about the social conflict that accompanied the earthquake. Well, basically, to summarize the economic story, on one hand, of course, the Building Trades Council was central to this, because the Building Trades Council was the Building Trades Council, and building was what needed to be done in the city. On the one hand, McCarthy and his fellow officials in the Building Trades Council did, for a time, try to discipline their member unions. For example, in July 1906, the council leadership opposed a strike by plumbers who were calling for a wage increase of $1 a day. And $1 a day was serious money back then. The average wage was about $3 a day. So, but the plumbers decided to go on their own because, after all, there wasn't enough skilled labor in the city yet. So they could get more money, and they felt they needed more money to pay for housing, and the cost of food was going up as well. So in general, the plumbers and other building craftsmen in the first year of Reconstruction raised their wages by about 20%, which they felt was necessary, but which scared a lot of employers in the city and those who identified with employers in the city, because they felt that, my God, if they raise their wages 20% this year, maybe 20% another year, and, you know, in 5 years, they've doubled their wages. So this, according to the business press and businessmen in general, was a very frightening development. Patrick Calhoun, the head of the United Railroads, a very powerful businessman, who had his own relationship with Abe Roof, the power behind the scenes of the United Labor Party. Nevertheless, even though he was willing to deal with a party called the United Labor Party, Calhoun did not like unions and tried to break unions on his railroads every chance he got. And in September 1906, Calhoun called McCarthy, quote, a czar with the power to strangle the future of a community. He was basically declaring war against the Building Trades Council and all powerful unionists in the city. In fact, at the same dinner where he gave this statement, Calhoun offered to restore normal conditions in 90 days, if a body of like-minded men would rally around him. So you had a whiff of the Vigilante Committee, you know, coming back to the city, those who know some San Francisco history. And of course, there had been Vigilante Committees not just in the 1850s, but also one in 1877 during this anti-Chinese riots and general strike. So, you know, it wasn't so long. This was a memory, a history that people in San Francisco knew. Workers, of course, protested that they were barely avoiding soup kitchens. They needed the higher wages. Early 1907, a few months after Calhoun's statement, the local commander of the army, Frederick Funston, gave some encouragement to labor's enemies. There had been a lot of tension between the army and local residents. After all, you know, look, San Franciscans didn't like being ordered around by anybody, and especially not by soldiers who didn't know, and who sometimes were kind of peremptory and used bayonets when they really should have been using words. In 1907, Funston wrote an annual report to the War Department, or had one of his aides write the annual report to the War Department. And in this report, which of course got made public not very long after he wrote it, revealed his distaste for unionism. He accused the building trades of fomenting senseless strikes and lockouts. He attacked all of labor for bidding up the cost of Reconstruction with its reckless wage demands. The crowning blow was a recommendation, quote, that all construction work, this is the general, all construction work at the ports on San Francisco Bay be done by prison labor. You know, if you wanted to get unionists mad in San Francisco, just tell them, oh, we just have the convicts from Alcatraz, you know, do the work. Funston was an ambitious officer. He'd already garnered headlines for his exploits in the Imperial War in the Philippines. And clearly for him, strikers were just undisciplined rabble, you know. They should be put to work under bayonet and gun. Olof Tveitmo from the Building Trades Council, who didn't take this kind of thing lightly, boasted that plumbers and hod carriers earned as much as a lieutenant, which they did, because, quote, the military and naval snob does not dare to say his soul is his own, much less take part in political agitation or discussion for an increase of his pay. So, you know, Tveitmo saying, you want to hire prison labor? Okay, maybe we should organize the workers, organize the soldiers and sailors, you know. So, as you can see, the earthquake love was turning into something closer to earthquake hatred. On the first anniversary of the Great Disaster, the leaders of organized capital celebrated the resurrection of their city separately from the leaders of organized labor, a symbol in itself of the division. Leaders of organized capital celebrated, guess where? At the Fairmont. Probably still do. 1,000 lawyers, I'm not sure how they got 1,000 people into the Fairmont, but 1,000 lawyers, businessmen, financiers banqueted with the governor of California, a guy named James Gillette. Pointedly, no unionists or supporters of Mayor Schmitz were invited. After the plates were cleared away, the president of the Merchants Association touched a button that illuminated 2,000 bulbs that were placed around the dome of the ruined City Hall, which became a symbol, as you probably know, of the Reconstruction spirit. Those, you know, all those photographs you still see of the shell of the City Hall. Meanwhile, in the Mission District, hundreds of Building Trades Council men and their families crowded into what was then the shiny new Sheet Metal Workers Hall, with a great eagle out front that used to be there. I'm not sure it's still there. To hear gives you a sense of the labor culture at the time. They listened to a German vocal quartet singing Lieder, a violin solo by Tveitmo's son, young Angelo Tveitmo. Mozart, I think, was the fair. And addresses, of course, by their leaders. McCarthy, by the way, was a violin player as well. Any labor leaders still play violin? yeah, piano's fine, too. McCarthy predicted that organized labor, having emerged stronger, he said, from the rebuilding process, would now spread its influence to unenlightened stretches of the far west. Tveitmo contrasted the post-disaster prosperity of labor with the dismal state to which Chicago's unions had fallen after the fire there in 1871. So it seemed that the two sides were ready for battle, but both sides were quite confident of winning. At the same time as the guests at the Fairmont were toasting their good fortune, they were also cheering two lawyers named William Langdon and his assistant, Francis Heaney, who were actually admonishing them, that is the elite of San Francisco, for viewing city government as an instrument to manipulate for their own ends. This is a little bizarre. Why would, you know, when people are admonishing you for corrupting the city and following your own self-interest instead of the interest of the city as a whole, why would they be applauded? The Graff prosecution, which some of you might know about and some of you do know about, I know, was both, I think, a part of the progressive era, progressive reform of cleaning up city government, of doing away with bossism in city government, bringing about civil service and other important reforms. But it was also, at least in San Francisco, where labor's power was so strong, an instrument to destroy labor's power by destroying the very imperfect political instrument that many working class people were faithful to at election time, that is the Union Labor Party. Now, I won't go into the whole history of the Graff prosecution. You can read it in many different places. Walton Bean wrote a book many years ago about Boss Ruff, San Francisco, which has a general story in it. You can read Bill Islambaugh Cherney's wonderful book on San Francisco, 1865-1932, which has a good summary of it as well. And you know, any of you who've been forced to take California history in school have heard about this, and I won't go into the details. But the important thing, I think, to realize about it was that, the prosecutors were attempting to do something which was really difficult given the class hostilities in San Francisco. That is, they were attempting to get rid of the corruption of the Union Labor Party supervisors, who'd been elected in 1905, who were on the take. Boss Roof was making sure that they were in on the money as well, as I mentioned before. But the graft prosecution also wanted to indict the higher-ups. In fact, it gave immunity to the corrupt supervisors, union labor supervisors, almost all of whom were union activists, in return for testimony against the real mucky-mucks like Patrick Calhoun, the head of the United Railroad, and some of the other corrupt executives in San Francisco who had been supplying the graft money. But in the short term, what the graft prosecution was able to do was to unseat the Union Labor Party. To make a long, complicated story short, in March 1907, before that dinner I mentioned where these prosecutors were applauded, a very clever, resourceful private detective, William Burns, who created the Burns Detective Agency, which is still around, entrapped one of the union labor supervisors named Thomas Lonergan with a bribe. Thomas Lonergan is an interesting guy in some ways. He was a bakery wagon driver and an official in the bakery workers' union before he was elected to the Board of Supervisors in 1905. And like a lot of, you know, working class guys in, you know, who were in the Board of Supervisors, you know, he wanted to do right by his fellow members. But at the same time, you know, he was a guy who never had much money, never had much opportunity. And all of a sudden, with the help of Boss Roof's skill at picking tickets to be ethnically balanced and balanced between different parts of the labor movement, all of a sudden Lonergan is in position to make some bucks, you know? And one of the ways he was found out, I always love this anecdote, was he told his daughter to, a young daughter, about 10, 11 years old, to go to the corner in the Mission District and buy a loaf of bread from the store. And sort of unthinkingly, he opened his wallet and gave her a $100 bill. which he'd gotten as part of his graft payments to buy a loaf of bread. Now, what a loaf of bread cost in San Francisco in 1905, you know, probably 5 cents, if that. This was a kind of act of bravado, perhaps, or act of total foolishness, but it showed that some of these guys were, you know, pretty unpolished, and in many ways it was easy to find them out. The entrapment of Lonergan later on for another incident opened the floodgates wide. The union labor supervisors quickly spilled their past dealings in exchange for complete immunity. As I mentioned, Abe Roof negotiated with the prosecutors for 2 months, and then he took an offer of partial immunity and pled guilty. Roof testified against Mayor Schmitz. Mayor Schmitz was convicted. The mayor went into prison, and there was no mayor of San Francisco. And the Board of Supervisors was, by their own confession, you know, guilty of corruption. In effect, the elected government of San Francisco had been overthrown by the prosecutors. Well, what to do? How do you get a government? Well, the prosecutors, with the help of Rudolph Spreckels, banker, reform businessman who was financing much of the prosecution. He spent $250,000 on the prosecution, which is still real money. And then it was quite a bit of money. They basically interviewed candidates themselves for mayor and for supervisor. For mayor, they chose a rather retiring, quiet man, but whose reputation was spotless, Dr. Edward Robeson Taylor, who was a 68-year-old doctor, also a lawyer, also a poet, not a very good poet, and the dean of the Hastings College of Law. In July 1907, the supervisors were ordered, in effect, to elect Taylor mayor. They did. And then they resigned to allow a new board, almost entirely composed of business and professional men who had opposed the Union Labor Party before, to become the new members of the Board of Supervisors. Tvitmo was one of the few labor people still on the board. Well, this sounds like, well, this was only supposed to be the first act. The prosecution was then going to use the immunity that they'd given to the supervisors to get to the higher-ups and really clean house, you know, make sure that business would never corrupt politics again. Well, guess what? The class hostilities, the class divisions, the class consciousness, to use that loaded term, of businessmen in the city was quite high, and they didn't like their own kind being targeted by the prosecutors. From men's clubs, from corporate offices, came loud complaints that the trials were going on too long. They were injuring commerce. They were ruining the city's reputation. Moreover, only Abe Roof could give evidence of bribery against Calhoun and other executives, and because he'd made the deals, and he refused to do this. And he claimed with, I think, some conviction that he was too smart a lawyer to have ever actually said, you know, where's the money? Give me the bucks. We need it. You know, he was never went on record saying that, you know. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, and so forth. So Roof said he couldn't testify, you know, about this because, you know, he really had never explicitly asked for money. Money just happened to appear. The prosecutors didn't like that. They revoked his immunity agreement and sent him to San Quentin. Roof was the only defendant in the Graff cases to ever serve more than a few weeks in jail. Schmitz was let out on a technicality later on. Well, as I said, I think that the accepted version of the Graff prosecution, which one usually hears in California history classes, in Walton Bean's book, though not in Bill Issel and Bob Cherney's book, is this just sort of talks about the prosecutors as being, you know, spotless, moral paragons, having nothing but the best of intentions, which in some ways they did, but on the other hand, the context really matters. Because when you have a class-divided city, when you have the kind of consciousness you have, when you have a party that officially is called the Union Labor Party, which has the votes of a majority of workers in the city, you know, when you unseat them, no matter how corrupt they were, you know, it's not going to bring about some sort of great class harmony. Everyone's just going to work together for the good of the city. You know, that's not how politics works in general, and that's not how politics worked in San Francisco in 1906 and 1907. The next act of the political drama of Reconstruction was the 1907 election. There was going to be another election. Mayor Taylor was appointed by the Board of Supervisors, which then resigned, but he was going to run for election for real. And there was a big debate in the labor movement about what to do. Should you support the Union Labor Party under new leadership? That new leadership, it turned out, was going to be, guess who? Patrick McCarthy and Olaf Twitmo, the Building Trades Council, who saw the ULP was still around. They didn't like the prosecution for complicated reasons I can go into, partly personal ones. There was a union labor supervisor who'd been convicted of graft, but also because they really, I felt, I think sincerely, that this was a usurpation of the power of workers. And they wanted to, you know, for their own reasons, take advantage of that. They opposed the continued prosecution, but they also argued that the takeover of the city government by the prosecution had been unjust. On the other hand, the Labor Council, the San Francisco Labor Council, for the most part, most of its activists and leaders supported Taylor, supported the appointed and soon to be elected mayor of San Francisco. In part, I think, because they were just embarrassed by the corruption. One Labor Council newspaper put it this way: a union labor government, which is worse than any other government, is a crime against union hopes. So they aligned with what was called the Good Government League, which in effect was the political vehicle of the pro-prosecution forces in the 1907 campaign. At the same time, they had to ally with people who clearly were opposed to labor political power generally, corrupt or not. Among them at the time was the former mayor and future senator James Phelan, who told an audience in 1907 he would rather live under an iron despotism than maintain a republican form of government under people like Schmitz and Lonergan. The novelist upper-class San Franciscan Gertrude Atherton, whose work some of you might know, called the ULP supervisors roof's tools, chosen from the dregs of the working class, men with no inherited ideals to give them moral stamina. Notice the whiff of eugenics there. No inherited ideals to give them moral stamina. So, you know, this was pretty raw stuff. Well, there's, as always in politics, a lot of complicated alliances back and forth. But generally, the debate in the 1907 mayoral election, which all of you probably remember, was between these two sides. You know, labor very much carried the argument on both sides. Labor council supporting the prosecution because they and the supporting Mayor Taylor's campaign, believing that this would cleanse labor's political image. And on the other hand, the Building Trades Council running Patrick McCarthy for mayor of the city, the most powerful labor leader in the city, running for mayor of the city under the Union Labor Party, saying that, you know, working class voters especially should support a union man to replace the union government that had been overthrown by the prosecution. Dwight Moe said at one point during the campaign, "The working men and women in San Francisco are enjoying the best wages paid anywhere in the world." Probably an exaggeration, but nevertheless, it was politics. "Do you think they will continue if the capitalistic class can usurp the municipal government and put the unions out of business?" So economic power and political power were very jointly, were seen together by Dwight Moe and many other people as well. Father Peter York, who was a charismatic labor priest and also an Irish nationalist in San Francisco at the time. Bill Issel's writing a book about Catholicism and labor in America in the 1930s and 40s, and there were many labor priests in the 30s and 40s in this town and others who supported the union movement at that time, but there also were labor priests in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and Father Peter York was the leading supporter of labor within the Catholic Church in this city. And he supported the ULP under McCarthy in 1907. He put it this way. He said, "The government of this country has been the monopoly of the men of the tongue and pen." Kind of a nice phrase. He thought that that government should be run and could be run by men who, you know, use their hands to make a buck. So class loyalty was the issue, and it was underlined in 1907 by a long violent strike, which took place just really as the beginning, the campaign was really beginning. And this strike took place, as luck would have it, on the United Railroads, the leading streetcar company in the city, which was owned by Patrick Calhoun, the target of the prosecution. The strike began in May 1907 when the Carmen's Union, which had 2,000 members, demanded $3 a day. Conditions which would have put them on a par with most manufacturing workers in the city, and below that of most building trades workers. Calhoun, who had ended a short strike the year before by agreeing to submit to arbitration, now decided he wasn't going to have any of it. He was going to tough it out. And he announced he would never again bargain with the Carmen's Union. In fact, not just that, but he imported strikebreakers from elsewhere in California and elsewhere in the West. And he did something which was very inflammatory and meant to be inflammatory. He gave them guns himself, privately, armed them, and sent them out to drive the streetcars on the city's major thoroughfares, down Market Street and, you know, Church Street and elsewhere. Thus, perhaps wittingly, I don't know, I've never looked into his history in detail, he provoked what I think remains the bloodiest strike in San Francisco history. Carmen and their supporters fought sporadic battles against scabs who shot freely in self-protection, while police usually looked the other way. Driver incompetence and striker sabotage caused numerous mishaps, injuring passengers and pedestrians alike. By the end of the conflict in the fall of 1907, at least 25 people had been killed and 2,000 injured. 2,000 injured, either by gunfire or accident. Some of these streetcar drivers had never, scab drivers, never driven a streetcar before, which is, you know, you've been on streetcars in San Francisco, it ain't an easy thing to do, especially up the hills and down the hills. And so there were a lot of accidents. And so the 2,000 injured includes people injured in accidents caused by the incompetence of scab streetcar drivers. The San Francisco labor movement put aside its internal quarrels, at least temporarily, to unite behind the carmen. Tvite Moe was, as he was usually, one of the more inflammatory speakers during these rallies. Mass rallies held to support the streetcar drivers, as he had, you know, dared the general of the U.S. Army to a fight, in effect. He said in 1907, first, that the Board of Supervisors should revoke the franchise of the United Railroads. And second, he pledged, quote, we must preserve unionism in this town, even if we have to wade through rivers of blood. On Labor Day, as we heard before, thousands of building trades marchers attacked a streetcar. In the battle with pistols and bricks, a young iron worker and a scab car inspector were killed. But the strike failed, in part, I think, because the Union Labor Party was not in power and could not force the police to disarm the scab streetcar drivers, among other things. Father York did assure the strikers they were fighting the battles of the Lord. Catholic priests used to do that. Maybe some still do. But Patrick Calhoun controlled the streetcars and could easily find men to drive them. The Lord didn't intervene, unfortunately. By late fall, all the hardcore strikers were fired and the union was utterly destroyed. Well, the election happened soon after the union was destroyed. As I said, the divisions in the labor movement continued electorally, even though they'd come together to support the streetcar strike. The McCarthy went around the city 12 hours a day, giving speeches everywhere, trying as hard as he could to whip up class consciousness against Taylor's ticket and calling for a union labor government is just as important now as it was in 1901 and 1903 and 1905. But most voters in San Francisco, though probably not most working class voters, wanted to forget the ULP, wanted it to get behind them. And they wanted the prosecution to continue, and they thought if you supported this fusion ticket, the Good Government League ticket, which fused with the Democrats that year, that the prosecution would continue. And so Taylor was elected, and the ULP seemed to be history. However, this is the last part of the story. 2 years later, McCarthy ran again for mayor. This time he won. Why did he win? Well, first of all, it was a three-way race, and so it's always easier to, of course, win if you don't have to get the majority of the vote. It was a three-way race in 1907, too, but the Republican candidate, a guy named Dan Ryan, was basically nowhere. He won, I think, 16% of the vote or less. But both major parties were up and running again in a serious way in 1909. McCarthy ran and got 46% of the vote. And he got a majority of the Board of Supervisors along with him. This picture on the front of my book shows the Board of Supervisors under McCarthy. And they're, you know, fine group of guys. Most of them Irish guys. But also the Graft prosecution, as I mentioned before, was petering out. It had not been able to go after the higher-ups. It just seemed to be spinning its wheels, wasting money, even though most of it was private money. And organized labor was willing to unite, again, behind a union labor candidate, and that union labor candidate was P.H. McCarthy. Well, he was elected in 1909, McCarthy was, and he was the last union labor mayor of the city for two reasons. First of all, his administration was a disappointment at best. The chapter I wrote about this, I call the misgoverning of San Francisco. He wasn't as bad as Schmitz and Roof had been, but he was not exactly a sterling representative of labor's interests either. He spent a lot of time working with the police department, making sure that brothel owners and saloon keepers wouldn't be troubled by various vice regulations. He was no prude, and there were a lot of prudes in San Francisco at the time, you might say, one way to put it. But he was, made himself unpopular because people expected that he was taking bribes from some of these guys. Also, he, more importantly perhaps, he promised that he would build a city-owned water system and a streetcar line, public streetcar line, the beginning of Muni, and there was beginning of the establishment of these lines, these public utilities, really truly public utilities under his administration, but they weren't completed as he had promised they'd be completed. And nothing hurts a politician more than making huge promises that you can't follow through on, unless you're George Bush. And it'll hurt him yet. Sorry, I digress. please digress. In 1911, McCarthy ran for re-election. Of course, elections, mayoral elections then and supervisory elections happen every 2 years, not every 4 years. Another reason why he was the last Union Labor mayor was because beginning in 1910, in a special election, the voters of San Francisco voted to make all city elections nonpartisan, which they still, as you know, remain. So he couldn't run, McCarthy, as the candidate of the Union Labor Party, because there was no Union Labor Party on the ballot anymore. He had to run as good old P.H. McCarthy. Some people liked, other people didn't like, but he was less popular as a personality, as a politician, as a single name, than he had been as a candidate of the Union Labor Party, which many working people in San Francisco wanted to support, no matter who was the candidate. Well, in 1911, McCarthy ran a really sort of hard-nosed, class-conscious campaign. He really damned his opponents, his foes of labor, rather wildly, in fact, because his main opponent, named Jim Rolfe, was a businessman, but not an anti-union businessman. And also, McCarthy, in one of the classic sort of fits of pandering, ethnic pandering that went on, he spent a lot of time in Irish and German working class neighborhoods. He danced Irish reels a lot. He tried to speak Gaelic, which was a popular thing to try to do at the time in the Irish community, but he didn't remember very much of his Gaelic, if he'd ever known much at all. And he drank many steins of steam beer and other beers in the German community. But Jim Rolfe, Sonny Jim Rolfe, as he was known, was a popular businessman. He grew up in the Mission District. He'd done a lot of relief work after the earthquake. Instead of sitting in his house and watching other people do the work, and some of the work he did while he rode on top a big white stallion. So, he's the man on the white horse. And he swamped McCarthy in a two-way race with 60% of the vote. Gradually, over the next decade, unions in San Francisco learned to get along with major party politicians like Rolfe and like Hiram Johnson, the governor of California, elected in 1910, later the senator from California, who were willing to, they were true progressives in the sense that they were willing to allow unions to exist as long as they didn't harm the economy or disturb the social peace, and as long, one should add, as they didn't try to become competitive politically with their own party. But gradually, open shop businessmen regained their confidence in the city and forced San Francisco unions on the defensive. In the early 1920s, in the beginning of what goes down in labor history in this country as the open shop period in American labor history, employers waged this very successful campaign to drive labor out of its bastions of support, especially on the docks and in the building trades. And labor in this city did not rebound, as most of you know, really until the general strike in the mid-1930s, and helped by the usually friendly policy of FDR and the New Deal. In the future, other labor officials would occasionally be elected to city office, most famously John Shelley, a former head of the Labor Council as mayor in the 1960s, but never again would they represent a party that, at least officially, was dedicated to serving the interests of union workers. Well, that's the history story, but what lessons can one draw from this story, from the struggle of unionists to keep power during a period of utmost crisis that followed the great earthquake and fire? Well, this will be more controversial probably than the other things I've said so far. Or maybe not, but at least it might get discussion going, which is why I put these lessons forward. First of all, when it comes to political activism, be careful what you wish for. The Union Labor Party was, on the one hand, the most successful union-based party in the history of American cities. It elected the mayor four times. It elected a majority of the Board of Supervisors twice, 1905 and 1909. Each time it elected the mayor, most working-class voters in San Francisco gave it their support. But after putting the Union Labor Party into power, union activists did not ensure that the city government was either in capable hands or honest hands. So when the Graff prosecution revealed the ugly truth, it inevitably harmed the reputation of labor as a whole. It inevitably made labor vulnerable to its enemies. In the end, I believe that the economic power of labor and the political power of labor have to go together. In the history of American labor, American labor has never advanced, at least very far, when it didn't have a rather friendly administration of power in Washington, and that's true for the most part in state governments and even in city governments as well. You know, people in the labor movement I know love to talk about politics in a negative sense, and most Americans do. Let's face it, most Americans don't really like politics very much. Think it's corrupt, think it's dishonest, think it's just a matter of, you know, ambitious men and women just trying to get theirs, whether it's money or media attention or whatever. But I don't think labor can make it without a portion of political power. At the same time, you know, make sure labor has to make sure that it keeps people it supports on notice and doesn't sort of let them go off on their own. Second lesson one might draw from this story: labor can seldom, if ever, in this country at least, gain power by seeking to represent only itself. Both Schmitz and McCarthy won the mayoralty in San Francisco by appealing primarily to the class resentments of the poorest white residents of the city. But neither man, in the end, had a positive program to offer other San Franciscans, and not that much of a program to offer most working class San Franciscans either, except for keeping the police neutral during strikes. So neither one was able to build a permanent union labor majority. In 1911, Jim Rolfe's campaign slogan, with which he won a landslide against McCarthy, was a very telling and effective slogan, I think. A mayor for all the people. McCarthy was a mayor for just the workers, and Rolfe was a mayor for everybody, including the workers. Unionists today have a similar problem, I think. Most are perceived, wrongly, as no more than a special interest, representing a declining number of privileged workers, instead of proposing changes that will help all Americans worried about their jobs, their income, their health care, their housing. I think that's wrong. I think it's not true. But of course, in politics, it's the perception that matters, not the reality that historians 50 years from now will discover when they write the labor history of the early 21st century. Only by changing that image, can American labor begin to grow again. Thank you.